Welcome to A Public Affair on KGNU. I'm Lily Noble, and I'll be your host for an interview with Lisa L. Lewis, health journalist and key proponent of California's school start times law. Today, Lisa will be joining us to talk about her new book, The Sleep-Deprived Teen, Why Our Teenagers Are So Tired and How Parents and Schools Can Help Them Thrive, which centers around teen sleep and the argument for later school start times. Lisa, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Can you start off by telling listeners a little bit about what the sleep-deprived teen is about?
Sure. So I basically wrote the book that I wish that I had had when my son was entering high school, which was back in 2015, which is what launched me on this whole journey. So basically, it's a book for parents to help them understand why sleep is so important for all of us. You know, a little just overview of what happens when we sleep, and also specifically what's going on in the brain during the teen years. A lot of information about why teen sleep matters, because when teens are sleep deprived, it has such far-reaching implications for everything. Nobody functions better when they're sleep deprived. And for our teens, that's especially true. So it has implications for academics, for drowsy driving, for athletes, particularly for mental health. And then I wanted to give parents the tools to be able to make some changes, both in their own homes to help their teens get more sleep, and also to help advocate for healthy school start times, which are such a key piece of this equation.
In The Sleep-Deprived Teen, you touch on the effect of technology use on sleep health, but that's not the only cause you mention, despite that cause often receiving the most attention. Can you walk us through some of the key factors surrounding sleep health?
Sure. So in terms of teens, I think what's key to understand just to begin with is that teens should be getting 8 to 10 hours of sleep every single night up until age 18. So teens who are, you know, in their junior and senior years of high school often look like adults, but they're not adults yet. And their sleep needs reflect that. So for teens, it's 8 to 10 hours a night. After age 18, it goes down slightly to 7 to 9 hours a night. But the issue is that so many of our teens are chronically sleep deprived. The most recent data was from the CDC, a survey done in 2019, and they found that only 22% of high schoolers were hitting that minimum of 8 hours of sleep a night. So that's like about 1 in 5 teens, and that means the rest of them are chronically sleep deprived. And there's another key piece too, which is that teens actually are on a later body clock when it comes to sleep. So there is what's called a circadian rhythm shift, which means that the timing of when teens feel sleepy and ready to actually fall asleep is later than it was when they were kids. And any parent knows this when they look at a six-year-old and they see that the six-year-old bounds out of bed early in the morning, runs hard all day, and then, you know, is ready to fall asleep by 8 o'clock at night. That is not the case with teens. And a big piece of that is because they are not feeling sleepy until about 11 o'clock at night, given that melatonin is released on a later schedule than it once was, and also doesn't recede until later in the morning. And so what that means is if a teen is not really able to fall asleep until 11 o'clock, you just do the math for them to get 8 to 10 hours. If they've got to be sitting at their desks at, say, 7:30, which was the case in my own district when I first got involved in this, makes it really hard for them to get 8 to 10 hours of sleep.
So there's a lot of research cited throughout the book, spanning studies throughout years and across the country. What was your process in compiling all of this research?
So my role in this really stemmed initially from being a parent. I have two kids. My oldest is, I call him a recent teen because he's now 20. And my youngest, I only have two, so she's 17 and she's about to be a high school senior. So my entree into this was when my son started high school, 2015. And at that point, our local high school began the day at 7:30 in the morning. So in addition to being a parent, I'm also a journalist, and I do write often about parenting topics that have to do with health, public health, education, parenting, and this was a perfect example of that. So I started looking into the issue of why our school started so early and quickly realized that it was not a unique situation. This was not simply the case in our community, and there was a large body of research already out there really looking at the fact that schools start too early and that that is an issue when it comes to teens. In fact, the previous year, 2014, was when the American Academy of Pediatrics had just come out with their policy statement recommending that middle and high schools start no earlier than 8:30 in the morning because of the impact that the start times have on teen sleep. So that actually began this lengthy journey. I really would not have predicted at the outset exactly how it was going to unfold, but I, you know, started looking into the issue, as I mentioned. I started writing about it, as I want to do. My first articles on teen sleep and school start times came out the spring of my son's freshman year. But there was an article that was published his sophomore year that really ended up kind of being the catalyst for everything that came afterwards. And that was an op-ed that I wrote that ran in the Los Angeles Times, which is the largest major daily close to where I live. It was called Why Schools Should Start Later in the Day. So that ran in September of 2016. And it was actually read by one of our California state senators, Anthony Portantino. At the time, he had a daughter in high school. Their high school was having discussions about whether to move to a later start time. So this was an issue that resonated with him. He started looking into the issue further, ended up introducing a bill on it in 2017. There's a group called Start School Later, which is a nonprofit advocacy group that's been around since 2011. They were a key information source for him and a resource. Meanwhile, because of my efforts in my own community, I had started at my own chapter of Start School Later because they were a resource I had identified through all my information gathering. So they looped in all of the chapter leaders in the state of California, of which I was one. So when this bill was introduced, I was actually on board even before it was introduced, and then stayed involved throughout this 2.5 year lengthy legislative journey. As part of that process, I ended up testifying at the Capitol, but I also ended up forging relationships with so many of these sleep researchers and experts around the country who were very supportive of this legislation. And so because of that, I then already had established, you know, this network of tremendous experts in the field, and went back and was able to interview so many of them as part of putting together this book, The Sleep Deprived Teen.
So you touched a little bit there on that legislative journey. What sort of challenges did you face on that legislative path, as well as your challenges compiling research throughout the book?
So I would say compiling the research was fairly straightforward. I mean, I ended up, when it was all said and done, I probably interviewed, you know, 50 some researchers, combed through so many of the research papers that are out there. A lot of these are out there, but they're in academic journals. So these aren't necessarily things where the information has been culled and compiled, which is what I was trying to do with this book. But in terms of the legislative process, it was interesting, you know, not surprising, but the same issues came up that really have come up in communities around the country that have made this change. Because I should note, California is the first state in the country to enact legislation of this scope, setting, you know, minimum start times. But there have been various communities, probably hundreds around the country, that have done this. Problem is, though, it's been on a patchwork basis. But the same issues tend to come up, and it was no different when we were looking at it at the statewide level. The first, probably the overarching one, is just a hesitancy to change itself, because making a change is inconvenient. It requires all sorts of adjustments. And particularly, parents who have kids in the school system are very, very aware of all of the fancy footwork that has to go on behind the scenes in terms of setting up your family's schedule so that it, based on what the school start time and end times are. So for instance, when my kids were in elementary school, it ended at 1:47 every single day. And that meant either my day had to end then and I had to be there to pick them up, or I had to have arranged some kind of after school care. So there are all these sort of wraparound things that parents have done based on school schedules. And when you look at making a change, that means changing those schedules. And it's already not a convenient situation. As parents well know, there are pretty much no parents out there who have jobs that exactly mirror the school day. Even teachers, you know, a teacher in that same school, their day does not end when the students go home, because then they've got grading and meetings and things like that. And parents, you know, already don't get off lengthy winter breaks or spring breaks or random days throughout the year that happen to exactly coincide with teacher prep days. So it's already a situation that, you know, has sort of been carefully constructed. And when you look at making a change, that is not something people are necessarily eager to do. So I think because of that, what we really tried to focus on was that this is a public health issue. The whole reason for changing school start times has to do with the fact that it's cutting into teen sleep, and that has these really harmful ramifications. And there's another key point about that, which is that these school start times were not established with student well-being in mind. When they were set, many times, it was years and years ago before this research was fully known, and they were set based on other considerations. So that leads me into the second major point, which is transportation, which is something that often comes up because, in fact, a lot of times these schedules were set based on the school bus service. So a given community or district may have one fleet of buses that they're using to pick up the elementary, middle, and high schoolers, but they're doing it on a tiered system so that they can use just that one set of buses. And when they originally set that schedule way back when, without knowing that teens actually have this circadian rhythm shift, teens were often by default put in the earliest time slot, thinking, oh, well, they're older, they should be able to handle it better. And then even after the research came out and became widely known, those schedules didn't change. So, you know, I refer to those as legacy schedules. And then the third piece that comes up often is sports, what the impact will be when you shift the day. You know, let's say you move it an hour later from 7:30 to 8:30, that means the end time moves later, which can then impact the timing of after school practices. But that too, you know, all of these have been addressed in every single community that has changed start times, which range from a community or district as small as one single high school to an entire city like Seattle. So these are all things that do need to be addressed. They're all legitimate issues, but they have been successfully addressed time and time again. And so those were the kind of concerns that came up that we in turn had to be addressing and discussing as part of this.
For listeners just now joining us, I'm Lily Noble, and I'm your host for today's A Public Affair. My guest today is Lisa L. Lewis, health journalist and author of the new book, The Sleep-Deprived Teen, which promotes later school start times to improve teen sleep. So a little bit earlier, you touched on the effect of circadian rhythms, how those affect teen sleep, and how they shift over adolescence and puberty. Can you give us a little bit of insight into just the basics of how circadian rhythms work and how they change throughout adolescence?
So, well, I should just mention here, I am not a medical expert. I am a parenting journalist. So I did talk to a lot of these experts who are the ones doing these type of sleep studies in their labs. I think the main takeaway for parents is just to know that there is this shift and that teens are not really feeling sleepy until about 11 o'clock at night. And that's a key point because in addition to sort of the main issues that come up, there are a lot of misconceptions that tend to come up in it, you know, that came up that we had to face that again have come up in other communities. And one of them is essentially people thinking that teens are lazy, like, oh, well, why don't they just go to bed earlier? And that's why I think it's so important for people to understand they can't go to bed earlier. I mean, you can, when you have a little kid, you literally put them to bed at a set bedtime. You don't generally do that with a teen, even if you could, and you were to put a teen in bed at 9 o'clock, unless they were just utterly, utterly exhausted, they're not going to fall asleep. And that has to do with this internal timing. So that's a really key piece because that is sort of one of those misconceptions. Oh, it's not that schools start too early, it's that teens are just lazy. And that is not the case.
So on a current events note, what are your thoughts on daylight savings time? Earlier this year, the Senate moved to make daylight savings time permanent, but many sleep experts say if we are to decide on a seasonal time, that standard time is healthier. What did your research find?
So I agree exactly with that. In fact, I did write an op-ed on that very topic for the LA Times right when that was all brewing. And I did speak to some of those same experts. And you're right, the expert opinion is that if we're going to have a permanent timing model, it should really be standard time. And, you know, it's one of those things we all recognize. It is a pain. Every, you know, predictably, like clockwork, twice a year, when we have to change our clocks, everyone grumbles about it because it's an adjustment. However, the key thing is that, you know, with daylight savings time, essentially, we are making it so that we're setting our clocks forward, which means the daylight is an hour earlier than it would have been. And in the summer, just because of the natural, you know, the way that the earth revolves around the sun, the days tend to be longer. So that, you know, you don't really see the same effect so much of, oh, all of a sudden, you know, when my clock says 7 a.m., well, now it's as light as it used to be at 6 a.m. because I just switched the clock. But if you do that same thing in, say, November, you're going to really see a difference. And in some parts of the country, that could be really, really pronounced. So what that would mean is that essentially it would look, if you switch your clocks and you stay in daylight savings time, it's going to look an hour earlier. And that means it's going to be darker. You know, in the winter is when the days tend to be shorter. There are fewer hours of daylight. And that is not in keeping with our circadian rhythm. So yeah, the official recommendations are, if we're going to switch, it really should be switching and making it permanent standard time.
In the Not All Teens Sleep the Same chapter, you focus on research surrounding disparities in sleep quantity and quality between races, genders, and economic backgrounds. Can you summarize for us how you found these factors affect sleep?
Yeah, that is such a huge topic. So as you're right, I did have a whole chapter on it, and it really was just to give parents an overview because there's so much to say on each of these. So I think just to start, I think the real takeaway is just to be aware that there are additional factors that affect teen sleep, in addition to the fact that they're teens and all the things we've been talking about, the circadian rhythm shift, the fact that they have to start school too early, in the fact that in many cases they're on overload when you look at all the different commitments on their plate. But there are additional complicating factors that can be that overlay on top of this for certain groups. So for instance, when you look at girls, and I should specifically say biological females, because this is biologically based, menstruation has an effect on sleep. And that is a fact of life, that girls' sleep can often be affected by monthly period pain. Some of the statistics I found, up to 93% of teen girls say that they get cramps, and that ranges from mild to severe, and those can impact sleep. And the other thing is just to recognize the scope of this. The data shows that about half of US girls have gotten their periods by age 12. So this is really affecting, you know, obviously such a huge portion of society. And specifically, we're talking about teen girls here, but these continue up through, you know, the whole time that women are, you know, in their childbearing years. Up until puberty, it was interesting, I was talking to some researchers about this. Up until puberty, they don't really see a lot of differences in the way that girls and boys sleep. But at puberty is when these differences start to emerge. So for instance, girls have a higher risk of insomnia. Girls take longer to fall asleep. These are just facts that I think it's important for people to be aware of, that these are additional complicating factors, which make it even more important to be giving teens, and you know, in this case, we're talking teen girls or biologically female, you know, teens, the opportunity to at least get enough sleep to start with. Same thing in terms of teens who may fall into additional categories, because there can be overlay. You can be female and you can also not be heterosexual. You can also be a teen of color, and each of these have their own, you know, additional complications. When it comes to sexual and gender minority teens and adults, the research shows that they do tend to sleep worse, meaning not getting as enough sleep and getting poorer quality sleep. And in many cases, that is surmised to be because of discrimination. And, you know, this is everything ranging from microaggressions on up. But the bottom line is that the sleep gap is significant. Same thing when you start looking at teens of color. There have been studies done that show, in general, teens of color sleep worse. Specifically, they've done studies looking at the Black-white sleep gap, because teens who identify as Black or African American do tend to get the least amount of sleep. For instance, looking at the CDC survey again, going back to 2019, when they found that overall, only 22% of high schoolers were getting at least eight hours of sleep. So that was overall. For white students, 23% were hitting that number. For Hispanic students, 22%. For Black students, 19.5%. So I think that is really, really telling. And then finally, there are additional impacts having to do with socioeconomic status, basically the impact of poverty in neighborhoods. And, you know, essentially the way to think about it is poverty chips away at sleep, because there are so many factors then in your life that can impact your ability to get a good night's sleep. Where you live may be noisy, noisy outside, noisy inside. If it's crowded living conditions, you're sharing a room. If you don't feel safe where you live, that's going to impact your ability to sort of peacefully drift off to sleep. If you're going to bed hungry, that's going to affect things too. So, you know, these are larger issues, but I think it's just important for parents to be aware that all of these also can impact sleep. And these are above and beyond all of the base stressors that teens already are facing.
So expanding on what you said about external stressors and base stressors, we are obviously living in a very eventful time in the United States. Lots of changes in policy, lots of big concerns that are weighing on teenagers. Can you tell us a little bit about how, if at all, these factors may affect teen sleep?
I think a very key factor when we look at this issue of teen sleep is recognizing the role that sleep plays in mental health. And sleep basically is a protective factor. So when we talk about mental health, we know that even pre-pandemic, teen mental health was an issue. And we know that it has gotten even worse since then, given everything that has been going on these last few years. So being sleep deprived basically makes everything that much harder in terms of dealing with all the various stressors in our daily lives, but it also intensifies emotions and heightens impulsive behavior, which is incredibly worrisome when you look at things like teen suicidality. And what they have found is that the less sleep teens get, the more their suicide risk goes up. So as a parent, this is the kind of thing that just sort of strikes fear into your heart, because this is a you know, very, very serious consideration to recognize that being sleep deprived really is a risk factor. It heightens anxiety. It heightens depression. So, I mean, this gets back to the point, there is nothing that we do better as teens or as humans when we are sleep deprived. It makes everything harder. And that absolutely is the case when it comes to mental health.
You wrote your book in part as a guide for parents of teenagers. What are the key ideas you'd like to leave with parents specifically?
I think what I would recommend is just trying to make sleep a priority overall. And that's for teens, but also for adults, to recognize our teens really do need to be getting 8 to 10 hours of sleep. We as adults need to be getting 7 to 9 hours of sleep. And they've done studies showing, you know, teens who are well-rested report fewer arguments with their parents. You know, clearly that's a good thing. In our households, everything goes more smoothly when you've gotten a good night's sleep. So to the extent we can help recognize how much sleep our teens really need and take steps to help them get it, whether it's helping them in the evenings in terms of helping, you know, promote the idea that yes, as a family, sleep is a priority, setting common sense tech rules, for instance, charging devices outside of the bedrooms, doing things to help our teens establish some kind of wind down routine to help transition into sleep time, and also looking at the role that our school start times play. All of this is so important because our teen sleep is so important.
In the final minute or so of our interview, what about the takeaways for teens who want to improve their sleep quality?
That is a great question. So teens themselves can have an impact in terms of advocating for later school start times. There are several terrific success stories where teens have taken a leading role in doing this. So I would absolutely encourage that. In terms of what to do, though, if you're at a school that starts too early, part of it is looking at what you do in your own home. So to the extent you can, trying to get to bed on time, trying not to work on assignments up until the last minute, which can be hard when the turn-in time has by default been set at 11:59 p.m. That does sort of tacitly encourage, you know, anyone, it's human nature, to wait and do it at the last minute. So not doing that would certainly be a best practice. And then another one that I, you know, one of the sleep experts I spoke to who works with professional athletes really advocates coming up with some sort of a wind down routine. So it's not being on your devices until the second you turn off the light, or even after you've turned off the light. Ideally, it's getting off of devices an hour before bedtime. It's doing things like looking at, you know, the lighting in the house and not having blaring lights on until right before you go to bed. Coming up with something, if it's reading a book, even if it's listening to a podcast, taking a warm bath, whatever it is that works for you, but having sort of a sequence of steps that you do that really is a transition so that you, you know, because our brains just don't turn off like a computer. It's not just an on off switch. So just recognizing that and doing our best that, you know, that for teens, for adults, for all of us to really try and set the stage to get a good night's sleep.
Thank you for taking time to join us today, Lisa. It's been wonderful speaking with you this morning.
Thank you for having me.
My guest today was Lisa L. Lewis, author of The Sleep-Deprived Teen, A Guide to Teen Sleep, and The Argument in Favor of School Start Times. I've been your host, Lily Noble, and you are listening to KGNU Boulder, Denver, and Fort Collins.